Members of the committee will come to order. I want to thank all the members who have managed to squeak back here just a few hours after we squeaked out of here last night. And members, if I can have your attention, it'd be great. Thank you. We're not at quorum, but we're going to get going. We have lengthy discussions to do today. We're not going to be acting on House File 3421. It is the chair's intent that we hear testimony on the background leading up to this bill, and then walk through the bill, hear from the task force, as well as from the commissioner, and then other stakeholders regarding the bill. We're then going to lay the bill over and bring it back for further discussion and action on Friday afternoon at 1 p.m. So with that, members, excuse me, I'm going to ask Mr. Kent Pakel, director of the College Access Consortium at the University of Minnesota, to come forward and tell us about the work of the task force that created what we're calling the Access System. And members, I will remind you that last year we created a temporary alternative through the year 2014 for the math grad high stakes assessment test for diploma conferral in our state. And as a result of that, we established a task force under the direction of the Department of Education to come back with recommendations for an alternative assessment system. And I participated in those discussions over the course of the interim. The task force was co-chaired by Mr. Kent Pakel and by Dr. Dirk Mattson, and the participants represented a broad swath of individuals, K-12 and post-secondary and the private sector, in talking through what might be a good new framework to replace our current MCA grad assessment system. So with that, I'm going to turn to, we are at quorum, so I will officially call us to order. And with that, I'm going to turn to Mr. Pakel to lead us through a discussion of the work of the task force. Thank you for being here today. I know that as a parent, that's a big deal early in the morning, and so I just want to acknowledge that and appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You should I should thank my son Adam, age 9, and daughter Victoria, who got their little behinds in gear a little faster this morning so I could get here. So I, on the record, want to acknowledge them, their first acknowledgement at the Capitol. Mr. Chair and members, we were together for a very interesting discussion at the 30,000-foot level about assessment. Your questions, I thought of all the ways I should have answered them since we were together a number of weeks ago. But that was really laying the groundwork for what I'm going to very quickly walk you through now. I know there's the commissioner and a number of other folks are going to add to this discussion. So this is a drive-through summary of what we came up with on the process that, Mr. Chair, you described. You have a copy of the proposal at your places, as do other individuals in the room. As you noted, this task force that I've had the opportunity of co-chairing with Dr. Mattson got started in May. We began by seeking feedback beyond the task force, and we thought maybe we'd get 20 or 30 responses. We had 260 over the web, some of them pages and pages long, about assessment and accountability at the high school level. We spent quite a bit of time, and then we brought together 20 people, the folks you'll see listed on the front end of that proposal, most educators from the K-12 or higher ed systems, but also a representative of the business partnership, who was a very, very positive contributor, although ultimately, as I know you'll hear, unable to support parts of the recommendation. So we had robust discussions. We also really bounced our ideas up against reality in schools at the end of our process through a very innovative effort that the Citizens League facilitated for us, where we asked teachers and kids, if this system existed, how would you react to it? So the result that you have in front of you is something we call the Access System. And like any good policy proposal, we desperately wanted a good acronym. And so we spent a lot of time staring at the letters ACCESS. And we ultimately came up with Achieving College and Career Readiness for Every Student's Success. And so access meaning really that we want to begin to point the arrows in our K-12 system towards success in some form of post-secondary education. And as we talked about during that discussion that, Mr. Chair, you convened a while ago, this is the paradigm shift that you're leading at the policy level and our teachers and administrators are living at the school and classroom level, from the point where a high school diploma was the end game to the point where a post-secondary credential, a degree, is the end game, to a point where our K-12 standards basically reflected what our K-12 teachers thought students needed to know and be able to do, to the point where the standards are focused on what kids need to know and be able to do to succeed in college and careers, to a point where our data in the K-12 system sits in one pot and our data in the higher ed system sits in another, and now we're trying to link the two. And finally, testing. The point where our K-12 tests used to mostly compare K-12 students to other K-12 students, and now we're trying to build assessments that measure readiness for life after high school. So what are the key components of the system that we came up with? You can read about them in that report, but let me just hit a very few key ones. The task force has recommended end of course exams, which you'll remember is a test that's given at the end of a defined class. And in this case, we've recommended the state establish end of course exams in high school algebra and biology, two subjects that Minnesota has already said all students must pass to earn a high school diploma. We believe the end of course structure is going to allow both individual teachers and the state to go deeper into those two critical bodies of content than a test that, as we discussed a couple of weeks ago, usually is called a comprehensive exam, which measures the knowledge and skills that are learned over multiple years. So we recommend end of course tests in high school algebra and biology, and we recommend that those tests count for 25% of the student's final grade in those two subjects. And as you know, if the student doesn't pass those two courses, they need to either repeat the courses or, as many of our districts are doing across the state, do so through a credit recovery process wherein they learn the content in another format. So that's what we recommend in math and science. We've recommended a comprehensive exam in language arts. So a test that in some respects is similar to the grad exam that exists, but a big change is we're recommending that we integrate writing into the language arts test. So we no longer would have a separate writing test, although the commissioner's proposal does recommend a structure that our task force did not consider. But I will say that is not in conflict with the recommendation that a student would receive two scores, one for writing and one for reading or language arts. But the kid would take the test at one point in 10th grade, which gives schools 2 years to help students who don't pass that assessment to catch up. There would be a cut score on the language arts exam. And the reason for that was it's very clear that literacy is a foundational skill no matter what the kid needs to do. But we've suggested that cut score should be set in part, as has happened in Minnesota and other states in the past, through bringing educators together to look at the content and say what's essential, but also, and a big change, by correlating that cut score with other indicators of success beyond high school. And so that actually we're empirically setting that cut score based on the high likelihood that a student's score predicts their readiness for college and careers after high school. So a comprehensive exam in 10th grade in language arts, end of course exams in high school algebra and biology. As we talked about very briefly in our last discussion, making the accountability requirement pass the course rather than pass the test potentially raises the specter of grade inflation, which is to say that will teachers feel pressure, and having been a high school teacher, I'll tell you the chances probably, to raise the grade because this is a high stakes indicator. That said, I think most teachers the vast majority of teachers want to bring integrity to their grading, and so the task force has also recommended what we call an alignment index, whereby the state would annually compare a high school's grading in those courses, the final grades kids are awarded in high school algebra and biology, and the high school determines which course, where those students learn that content, to the scores the kids get on the end of course exam in that course. And what we're going to look at there is the degree of alignment. And high schools that are highly misaligned, our task force recommends, there's a sunlight provision that should be shined on that, because grades, until the end of high school, are the primary measure we give kids and families of their readiness for higher education. And I'm sure, members, it is familiar to you to have kids who progress through junior and senior high getting passing grades, but then ultimately finding themselves unable to succeed on an external measure of assessment. So we've also recommended for math and science an alignment index. two other key points, and then I'll stop. The task force has also recommended that while the number of tests we're giving, especially compared to some other states, Texas is going to move to 11 end-of-course exams. We're recommending biology, high school algebra, and English language arts, 3. The number of tests in the proposal is nationally, compared to other states, very limited. We are recommending multiple pathways, because we really want to move away from sort of this industrialized, one-size-fits-all, everybody march in lockstep through high school model. And so as you'll see in the proposal, the task force does recommend that if a student achieves a score that equates with college and career readiness on an advanced placement exam, on an international baccalaureate exam, on the ACT assessment, or in the task force recommendation, gets a grade of C- or better in a credit-bearing college course through post-secondary options or another dual credit opportunity, they also would meet our state high school accountability requirements in that subject. Final point. The task force also was unanimous in endorsing the state becoming very involved in what in my wonky world of K-12 is often called formative assessment. But the best way to think about it, as we talked several weeks ago, is the front-end tests that help classroom teachers or administrators begin to measure where kids are on the way to the summative assessments. And so we've recommended two types of early front-end support and assessment. One are benchmark assessments that are actually mini-tests that are aligned with the summative tests and can be used to actually predict performance on the final assessment. And the second is an item bank of the kind of items that will be on the tests that individual classroom teachers can use to begin to prepare their students for success on those tests. So the front end piece of moving into the realm of support. And our task force felt very strongly about this because, frankly, even in our larger districts, and Mr. Chair, as you know, I spent a lot of years working in St. Paul schools, which is the second largest district, but even in St. Paul, much less in our charter schools or smaller districts, their capacity to do that work is very limited. And so our task force felt that it was important that the state begin to move into the formative and diagnostic realm and assessment. So that's a very quick overview. There are many, many other items that are summarized in this report. And I would just end by wanting to thank both all of you as legislators and Commissioner Segrin for the opportunity to work on this since May. I think we had a robust discussion. A lot of members made a long journey from their initial starting points on some of these issues. And I believe we have a good proposal for you to consider.
Thank you, Mr. Pacow. And I have to say, I would echo your sentiment of the quality of the discussion and the willingness of the group to journey and explore creative but powerful and research-based approaches to the charge that was before us. I also want to acknowledge, even though well, they're not listed in the working group because they weren't officially part of the working group, but I do want to acknowledge Representative Kathy Breinert and also Senator Sandy Rummo, who were present at perhaps even more meetings than I was present, able to make. So I want to thank you, Representative Breinert, for your presence and for your counsel and advice throughout the course of several months. Members, this is a big thing, and so I want us to within the confines of, you know, the artificial restraints that we have, you know, we have deadlines, our first policy deadlines by the end of this week, which means we're under a lot of expectations to forward a bill. And, of course, bills can continue to be shaped throughout the entire legislative process. But obviously, this being the policy committee, I would like to have the most informative, powerful shaping happening with this body. And so, again, I will be laying the bill that we'll hear about in a few minutes over for members to spend more time thinking about and being challenged by and come back Friday for an initial decision relative to the bill that's been brought forward, which reflects in part the work of the task force. Let me just, Ms. Pacow, if I can just ask a couple of quick questions, and then I will have the commissioner come forward and talk about or explain the bill that she's crafted, because our legislation actually asks for the commissioner to bring recommendations forward after the work of the task force. But one thing that that I've been struggling with is, and this is, so this gets us a little bit into the detail, but the alignment index issue. The highly misaligned concept, and part of what I like about this concept is that I think part of the group was balancing, trying to work off a principle where they were balancing issues of consequence across the different players, if you will. So make sure that students have both incentives, supports, and consequences, if you will, if that's the right word, but also systems and schools. And so I think the alignment index, not totally, but partly gets us to that issue. It's the highly misaligned concept. Is that one that's defined by a severity of alignment, or is it one that's defined by a persistence of misalignment?
Mr. Chair and members, in the task force discussions, it was both, which is to say if a high school has multiple years of seeing that their end of course grades, the final grades in algebra and biology, are way different than the student scores on the end of course exam, they would be categorized as highly misaligned. And in the task force recommendation, the consequence of that is really a sunlight provision, that there needs to be publishing of that, there needs to be discussion of that, and there needs to be a plan to rectify that. I know the bills before you actually go some steps further and take steps beyond that. As you know, Mr. Chair, we did not have discussion in depth of that idea. So I don't want to say that the task force either took a position for or against more consequences. I'll tell you, as somebody who led an effort to rethink class rank in St. Paul and weighted grades, and who's again been spent a lot of time in high schools, the degree to which the primary incentive that we give, indicator of readiness that we give kids and families, which is grades, is often, though not always, not aligned with other measures is striking. And so this is an effort, I think a discrete and limited effort, to try and bring what you might call truth and transcript to the dialogue. We need to be cautious, though, not immediately assuming that it's the teacher that's wrong. We're saying when you have misalignment, at minimum, we're sending conflicting signals. Then there's a discussion that needs to happen. Maybe there are reasons. Maybe there are really solid reasons for that discrepancy. That's a discussion that we think this state policy would promote. And I'll tell you, it'd be a challenging one. I remember sitting on the east side of St. Paul at Johnson High School when we were talking about that issue of class rank, and it's an extraordinary urban high school and a committed faculty, and it was a heated discussion about whether we should give honor points for, you know, accelerated classes and things like that. And a teacher stood up and said, "Well, this is very nice, but I want to be honest. I've been here 15 years. We've never had a discussion in this high school about what an A means across the school." And her point was a powerful one. And yet every kid is getting an A in those various classes. We're giving us common signal symbol. And this is the reason I mentioned Johnson, is it's an extraordinarily well-run school. So I'm using a high-performing school with a lot of challenges in this example. There was no effort across that school to really bring coherence to grading. And so are we surprised when we have kids who, you know, walk into their, you know, advisors or counselor's office and juniors and say they want to go be a doctor, and they're not going to ever touch advanced mathematics or science in high school? We haven't been giving them clear signals on their journey. This proposal doesn't fix that, but we think the alignment index, Mr. Chair, would be one useful way to begin to bring some coherence to grading and an external measure, which in this case is an end-of-course test.
And Mr. Pickell, it seems to me, and I'll explore this with the commissioner as well, because they as you indicate, they also, bless you, they also have a acknowledgement of the misalignment, alignment framework, and then they have a different set of consequences, right, that would flow. But it seems to me that, and Representative Greiling, this perhaps becomes a more pressing issue once this concept moves into finance, but it seems to me that begs some pretty strong capacity issues at the Department of Education in order to interact with school districts around exploring this discussion. So in other words, we can either approach this from, as you indicated, that there's just an assumption that there's, you know, these are my words, not yours, bad folks at play here, and so let's just really spank them, if you will, which doesn't probably require a whole lot of technical capacity, discernment activities, or we can approach this from a perspective of a deeper exploration of practices that perhaps need to be differentiated based on the conditions of the school, the mix of teachers, et cetera. And that, in my mind, begs, you know, some pretty strong capacity issues for the department that gets us to some potential resource issues as well. Representative Briner, I think, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I won't belabor this, but it does build on your question, and it does relate to the commissioner's proposal as well. With regard to the alignment index, are you aware of any other states that have used such a tool? Is there a research history here? And what steps would be necessary to validate this type of index before we move to consequences in its application?
Mr. Pickett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Briner, we did look at that. There are a fairly significant, though not large, number of just research studies have been done that look at this issue, which is to say it's not a part of a state or district accountability structure, but a researcher just went to look at it. And it's pretty interesting. Often they find that you have the misalignment is not sort of, it doesn't track with one type of district, as in more affluent, more high poverty. It's not as though districts serving a lot of high-need kids are much more likely to be misaligned than districts that are not. In the limited studies that have been done, there's no sort of commonality of a certain type of school that is more likely to be misaligned. The states like Georgia and others that have tried to do this at the state level, there are a number of states that have done some of the technical work that we can learn from. And Dr. Mattson could, I'm sure, describe for you, and I've seen the pictures which make my my head spin, the different ways that you would help count that end of course test for 25%, and then that you would measure the degree of alignment. There are a number of different ways we could do that. It has technically been done. I'm not aware of another state, however, that has used it in its accountability framework, which is to say for consequences of whatever type. And again, the task force did not consider consequences really beyond shining a light on it and saying you have to do a plan to address it. There was brief discussion beyond that, but I can't speak to the degree to which we really pushed beyond it. I'm not aware of another state, though, that includes this in its high school accountability framework. And so that's both, Representative Briner, I think, exciting in that it's putting Minnesota, as we've often been in the past, on the front end of reform, but it's also disconcerting in the sense that we'd be charting some uncharted territory there.
Just
a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, Mr. Pickell, you're probably aware of my concern, but I want us to proceed a little bit more cautiously and systematically than we did with No Child Left Behind in some of these arenas, where in our effort to hold schools accountable, we've used measures that haven't been appropriately vetted over time. And so I just don't want us to leap to consequences before the data warrants the connection. And what I'm asking of all those who have been involved in this process is, please let's stay in the conversation together as we move forward, because in our effort to hold schools accountable, we may not have accurate measures, and I think that would be a huge mistake. It's complicated. It's partly why we ended up where we are in terms of the grad test right now, is that we didn't have the data to warrant the position we were taking.
And I think what I'm hearing, Representative Briner, from Mr. Pickell, is that, and so this is a good point to raise both here because of just the overall concept here of alignment, but I think also in my bill, in the department's bill, where we have a, some might say, a pretty severe consequence, I think then your caution probably needs to be emphasized, and the committee needs to struggle with that. But I think what I'm hearing from the task force and from Mr. Pickell is that the consequence, if you will, here, has more to do, you use the word sunlight, kind of approach that sets up an opportunity to have perhaps the kind of relationships and dynamics unfold with the department and school districts in terms of getting deeper into, to some degree, perhaps emulating some of the experiences that Mr. Pakel shared with the St. Paul schools in regards to Johnson High School. So having that sort of mature discussion is what I'm hearing. And I think part of the principle here, members, and I'm just, you know, trying to be, you know, help us be clear about principles, is a belief, if you will, that our teaching corps is more often than not in search of good guidance and validity and enhancement in regards to their grading practices, and that there is an acknowledgement here that grading is not necessarily a scientific uniform kind of thing that's happening out there. Mr. Pakel, can you say something quickly about the phase one, phase two approach that the committee used to help us understand what the thinking was behind that and how we separated out the courses that are identified and those, and how the task force proposes transitioning into those phase two expectations?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Very briefly, as you know, we decided we wanted to do a few things well before we tried to do more. And so the phase one approach that we recommended is the one that I've described. Phase two was, in our the language of the report, contingent upon success and resources being sufficient resources being available through phase one. The two big issues that we thought the state should grapple with in phase two, and there are others, but the two big ones are adding end of course tests and potentially or not additional accountability requirements in the other courses that Minnesota currently requires high school kids to take, which is geometry and a choice of either chemistry or physics. We said the state in phase two, based on the lessons learned from phase one of this proposal, should consider adding end of course tests in those recommendations, and again potentially adding them to the accountability framework, but should do so based upon the lessons learned in phase one. So that's big idea number one in phase two. Big idea number two is one that, frankly, the institution from which I collect a check, the University of Minnesota, and our state colleges and universities and others are going to need to grapple with. But that really is actually not just having this being a system built just on sticks, but also carrots. Are there some ways, and the university system, Mr. Chair, as you know, in California has done this, are there some ways in Minnesota that we can begin to make your last high school test your first college test, which is to say a placement exam? Can we begin to point kids who are in high school toward you're ready for credit-bearing work at Century College or Vermilion or St. Cloud or Hamlin or the university? So the phase two hope, and I'll tell you, the higher ed institutions are open to this, starting with my boss, Bob Brunix, but they're going to need to see a state high school system that produces multiple years of data that we can dig into. Can we begin to actually place students based upon our state high school assessments, potentially as we do with advanced placement and international baccalaureate award credit for it? Can we begin to actually have a system that really aligns those high school assessments with the tests that are used to place kids in post-secondary education? That's an that's the other second big idea in phase two that we hoped both you as policymakers and especially our higher ed leaders would be able to grapple with.
And then another question, Mr. Pakel. The end of course, the weighting of the end of course exam, the task force settled on a 25%. Can you talk a little bit more about that, and then also help us put that recommendation within the context of what else we're seeing across the nation? With those states who are using an end-of-course exam. Is that on the high end, the low end? How do we either differ? What do we know? What have we learned from states that have used end-of-course exams relative to the task force recommendations?
Mr. Chair and members, it's on the high end of what we were able to find. The states that do a structure like this, and there are not there are a lot, though there are a number, are usually at 10 to 15%. those of you who've been teachers know that it's always a question of how much should I weight my final exam in the final grade. Teachers, especially at the high school level, are always given a final exam. Usually they wrote it. 25% for the task force was both robust but also limited. Some international assessment systems, like in Singapore and New Zealand and other places, also use an end-of-course structure where the test is developed outside the school and it's combined with measures that happen inside the school. Very interestingly, in those systems, the other measures also have accountability requirements. That would be a fascinating additional discussion where they bring teachers together to look at actually how you assess performance packages, but that's a deeper discussion. Those are also rarely higher than 25%. So this proposal puts us at the upper end. Some will say, but that leaves 75% that is at the discretion of the teacher. This proposal is based upon trusting our teachers. Our premise was the people who were expecting to teach the math and science, we should trust to grade the math and science. That said, an external test and the alignment index, I believe, again, having been a high school teacher, will give those teachers some, for lack of a more artful way to put it, some cover. To say, look, you are not ready, and I like you. I know you've tried, but I can't give you this grade because they're going to be comparing the grades to the test scores, and I'm also not doing you a favor by moving you beyond this course when you haven't really mastered high school algebra. So 25%, Mr. Chair, is where we settled. I'm sure that you on this committee, as yesterday in the Senate, will have a discussion about whether that's too high or too low. I might conclude, Mr. Chair, by suggesting that the experience in a number of other states that have traveled this road about high school accountability would suggest that we might want to keep in mind the Goldilocks standard, which is sort of not too high, not too low, because that's not a bad place to be when we're dealing with, as Representative Breinert noted, uncharted territory in the policy arena.
And then finally, at least finally for me, Mr. Pacow, and I'm jumping around a bit, but earlier when you talked about the phase one, phase two, and being able to have a process where we're learning from phase one relative to resource issues and successful outcomes that I imagine successful implementation assessments of how we're implementing. The task force creates a advisory, I forget what we're calling it, but some kind of an advisory group. Is it the recommendation then that be the group that does this kind of work? And how dynamic do you think the task force expects that kind of an entity to, how dynamic does the task force want that kind of entity to make this decision, or are those decisions meant to be decisions that we just do statutorily or that the commissioner does unilaterally? And just speak to the concept of this advisory group.
Mr. Chair and members, it really is, I'm glad you raised it. The fundamental issue here, for lack of a better way to put it, is trust. This is a policy framework within which many very, very big decisions need to be made. Where do you set that cut score in language arts? What is on the algebra and biology exams? How do you design the appeals process in language arts? All of those are very big decisions. I think the good news in this proposal is it would give us a broad framework and set of priorities within which to make those decisions. That said, we all know that those are decisions that will be made in some cases by people who are not sitting in the chairs that currently a lot of us are sitting in. So how do you as policymakers focus those future discussions without constraining the flexibility of the educators and policymakers and others that we'll bring to the table? We recommended as part of the way to deal with that, Mr. Chair, that there be a body that reports to the commissioner and to the legislature on the implementation of this system by essentially saying they're on track or they're departing from the vision, at which point you as policymakers and the commissioner would be able to make a decision about whether that's a good thing, we're improving on it, or a problem. I know the bills before you recommend actually charging an existing committee with that responsibility rather than creating a new one. Given that we all probably need more committees like a hole in the head, I think that the principle for the task force was not we need a new committee as much as it was there needs to be a very thoughtful group that's charged with saying this is deviating from the plan. you need to think about that. And so I would suggest that that structure is a very critical component of this process.
Thank you. Members, why don't we transition then to the next testifier. Mr. Pacal, one of the things that I want us to be able to have a bit of a handle on by the end of this hearing is to not only understand these new concepts and what the key elements are, but also to be able to differentiate between what the department has proposed in the bill that I'm carrying versus what the task force recommendations are. So I want us to understand where those differences are. And so we may come back to you to help with that, but I would certainly ask the commissioner as she walks through the bill to also help delineate those differences. So thank you for your testimony, and look forward to ongoing discussion. I'm sorry, Mr. Pacal, we had a question for Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pacal, I was interested in the discussion of the alignment, and I'm sure you'll take seriously Representative Reinhart's concerns. But I would urge you not to be frightened away from moving in that direction. When I was teaching a college and a college and schools course at the University of Minnesota with a colleague of mine, we did take into consideration over the years that we taught that the college placement tests that our students took to kind of reconsider our grading, and we found it very, very useful to do it. Grade inflation is an enormous problem. In my district, we had problems even with counselors changing grades without teachers knowing, and administrators doing the same. A lot of pressure from parents whose children wanted to go to Ivy League schools, and the grades were not high enough. Also, this colleague of mine has been teaching at one of the private colleges here in the Twin Cities in the same subject area, but was told point blank that his grading was too tough, and they really didn't need him around anymore in that regard. And I bring that up so that I don't know if this is part of your preview or not, but the grade inflation at the post-secondary level is also a very big problem, and I don't know whether or not that would be an area that this task force had looked into at all. Also, there was always concern brought to me and others that the high schools were not preparing students sufficiently, and so the colleges were spending lots of money on preparing them with remedial courses. And I did ask many of those professors, why did you admit them? Why didn't you send those students back to us with a little stamp on the forehead saying, unprepared, do it again? So this alignment issue is an enormously important one, I think, and I would encourage movement in that direction with the cautionary notes that Representative Reinhart indicated.
Mr. Pacal, I take that as affirmation and advice, and we no doubt we'll spend some more time vetting through the alignment issue. What I do want to do is bring the commissioner down. And I'm sorry, Commissioner, I don't know if you're presenting the concept or if it's your staff, but whoever from the department, if they can come forward and talk to us about, share with us the department's approach in working with the task force's recommendations and highlight what your recommendations are as they're captured in House File 3421. Good morning.
Good morning. We are going to be looking at the bill. So if you have that in front of you, I will go through the bill with you. I will highlight where the recommendations of the work group are followed, and then there are just really three basic areas where we where I did not follow the recommendations. We want to point those out to you. So we'll start first of all with the reading, writing exam. The recommendation for the work group was to combine the reading writing exam And that is something that I certainly agreed with and followed. However, I did ask the question, what would happen if a student failed writing or failed the reading? Could they then pass the whole test? And the answer was yes. So I suggested that we have separate cut scores and separate expectations, even though the test would be administered all at the same time, so that we would have assurances that students could write and read well before they graduated from high school. So the next thing we wanted to do was to make sure that we have achievement-level descriptors in both reading and writing that define a student's preparedness for college and career. That is part of the recommendation, and we follow that. However, in 10th grade, it's going to be hard to set a college and career-ready score that really is accurate. We might be able to do some kind of high correlation or high possibility, but 10th grade is a little bit early to set that score. Also, we require a remediation plan that is designed locally for each student that does not achieve a passing score after two retests. That's part of the recommendations. And then also there are some ways that students are either exempt from this test or can prove that they meet the same requirements, and those are listed in your Clause 10. You can read those for yourself. I'm not going to go through those with you. Then we're going to move to paragraph B, and that is the math and science end of course. That is the recommendation that was from the work group to have end of course tests with a 25% part of the course grade. The test uses 25% of the course grade, and I accepted that recommendation. Because in my rationale, and you will have the business community testifying, and they had a dissenting report, and which I highly respect their position. They would have liked to have cut scores in science and mathematics. I believe that having a minimum cut score does not really indicate or get to an alignment thing, and I was highly intrigued by the alignment process and thought that that was a better process. Plus a 25% of the course grade, given that we have ramped up our standards and expectations in science and mathematics, where we can really be assured that our students who are taking these courses, if they are aligned with the standards, are going to have some very wonderful educational opportunity to be college and career ready. So I think that it is a much more robust standard than a minimal cut score. Then also, we will establish levels of achievement on the exam through a methodology that is approved, scientifically approved methodology. Those students who fail the test will and have to retake the test or go through credit recovery also would be required to take the test again and have 25% of that attributed to their grade. This is a departure from the recommendation. Actually, the work group probably did not discuss this as I talked to Mr. Mattson and Mr. Bacall. That wasn't necessarily discussed, but I thought if you're going to retake the test or the course and pass it, you should have the same standard. We shouldn't lower the standards. Then there in Clause 9 are the ways that the exemptions are other ways that you can show that you're college and career ready. And then we are preparing. Now, this is where we deviated, or my recommendation departs from the work group. The recommendation was to have an alignment index, which I thought was a very good thing. What we decided to do is that as we're transitioning from the grad requirement to this end of course, there will be a 3-year time period where we will be doing both. And as we are looking at that, we will be able to we'll start to do the alignment, and we'll be able to report back to schools that their courses are not aligned and give forewarning. And then after that 3-year period of time, this transition or implementation phase, then there will be a 2-year period of time where if 2 years consecutively they are still reported as having highly misalignment, then they must report to the parents in 7th through 12th graders that their students in high school have been participating in some highly misaligned courses. Then the other thing that was totally my idea, but was based on some of the discussion that the work group did have about some consequences. There was recommendations that the diploma granting authority be taken away from the high school. I didn't think that made a lot of sense because, you know, there's lots of kids that should receive a diploma besides those kids that did not pass. I wasn't sure who would be given that diploma granting authority. Someone said the commissioner. I'm not really, or any commissioner in the future, I don't think would be real excited about getting into looking at everyone's records and trying to determine whether they get a diploma or not. So I thought about this a lot, and I thought, well, if there are some consequences that people desire, they should be fair, they should be very narrowly constructed, and they should be not only dependent on the student's responsibility, but also on the system's responsibility. So what you see before you in Clause 12 is that if a student's was in a highly misaligned course that was reported, now this would be after 5 years because there's 3 years of this preliminary, you know, work to get courses aligned, and then 2 years of still consecutive misalignment. If that student graduates from high school and enrolls in a post-secondary institution 1 year after graduation and discovers that they need remediation in math or science, then the district must pay for one course of remediation. I felt that that was a way to balance the responsibility of the system and assuring that that student who was in that class knew that they were being taught the standards that were expected of them and what that course was called, an Algebra 2 course, that there would not be any grade inflation and there would not be any dumbing down of the curriculum and telling the student that they had done well when indeed they had not been taught what they should be taught and had been told that they were successful when they were not. So that was my suggestion. It's very narrowly constructed. We do have the ability to, because of our longitudinal data system work, be able to track that student back to the class that that student had taken that was highly misaligned. And we would move forward with that as I think a balance, because the work group talked a lot about not putting all of the burden on the student, being fair, and also we need to have the fair expectation that the system also delivers. So then we also, in paragraph C, also note that the college and career readiness score will be placed on the student transcript. That is what business people look at when they're going out to hire somebody. They go back and they look at the transcript, and that would be noted if a student had made a college and career level score on their test. There is in paragraph D just to some transition language as we transition from the grad into this new system. It's just language that makes clear that there will be this necessary process, just as we transitioned out of the DST into the grad, just as we're going to transition from the grad into this new system. And then there was discussion, the chair asked Mr. Bakel about phase one and phase two. I read the analysis of whether we should wait to on phase two before we established end of course tests. My recommendation to you is to go ahead and begin creating those end of course tests because they take a while to do. We then would, but you will notice that it's required for districts to use the tests, but I did not have a recommendation. I am silent on how, whether there should be stakes or anything with that, but just that we need to implement some end of course tests in geometry and then in chemistry or physics, because as you know, we are requiring 3 years of science with biology and either chemistry or physics as a choice for graduating. This again will help our system make sure that we have some consistency and alignment if we want to do any kind of alignment, but I'm silent on that. but let's go ahead and start getting these end of courses tests prepared so that if you all want to do that in the future, you can, and we can move forward. The other thing that I departed from, and it is not because I do not want to do it or because our staff does not want to do it, I'm fully in agreement, is the formative tests. The only reason that is not included is because of the cost factor. We literally, in our testing budget, don't know how we could do that at this point. In fact, in our Race to the Top application, that was one of the reasons we were so hoping that we would at least be a finalist, and hopefully we will do a phase two, but that is included in our Race to the Top budget, the appropriation to do the formative types of tests. You had the discussion about test items, benchmark?
Item bank.
An item bank is very expensive in addition to the formative tests, and Mr. Mattson can probably answer questions about that. It's one thing to do the formative, but then to also do the item bank would be in another additional expense that that we would have to account for. But that is the only reason, and you know, to the extent that we can move forward with that, we will certainly do that. As we go to computer testing, that will start to save some money, but of course that is down the road. Until we get there, we're not going to see the savings. So that first has to be, of course, all those tests have to be constructed, and then they have to be applied. And we're going to also be still, as you think about this, we're still going to be having our paper pencil tests as well as starting to bring our online computer tests. And it's sort of like living in an old house while you're building your new. You have to have some place to live until your new house is ready to move into. So you have to still pay the costs of living in that old house and keeping heated and you know, up to speed as you're waiting for that new house to be built. Once that new house is built, you can move in and you can close down your old house and you can save your costs. But until that happens, we're keeping two systems alive here. And I was just in Washington, D.C. on Friday talking at the national level about computerized tests versus paper pencil tests. And all states are looking to move towards computerized, but they're all grappling with the same issues we are. Of how to do that and how to make sure that we have the capacity and some of the pros and cons about that. So those are the things that I would bring to you and recommend to you. I really compliment the task force for the many hours that they did spend looking at the research behind this. We were very fortunate at the time that this work group was meeting that we also were receiving technical assistance from a national group of people, CHIEVE, the Ed Council, Jobs for the Future, and it was a CHIEVE also, was it not? And Data Quality Campaign. So there was the ability also to bring in a lot of national experts to ask these questions and find out what is going on nationally and to bring in the research. So it was a very well-run work group, and I think the recommendations are very balanced. And would encourage you to also support the recommendations that I have laid before you.
Thank you, Commissioner. My compliments to you, both on making sure that the task force had access to expert resources, both within the state but also outside of the state. That was very helpful to the deliberations of the task force, and also my compliments to you also with wrestling with the recommendations and shaping up your thoughtful recommendations, which I think for the most part are in fidelity with the task force's thoughts. So let's open up for some questions. And Commissioner, let me ask, so I want to go through this issue of the phase one versus phase two moving ahead. What's in the bill is a more assertive posture relative to that, and I get that, you know, there's we don't want to lose time not developing, and of course, instruments relative to those pending new graduation requirements, because those are on the books, those are coming. But I'm nonetheless a little bit wrestling with, and this is not meant to be critical of the recommendation from the department, I'm just wrestling with from the, and perhaps we'll hear a little bit from districts about this, just how, what are they supposed to do with these end of course exams? Once I get that we should be working on and developing, they're not easily developed overnight. And I think that's what you're wrestling with as well, trying to be very responsible about just not, you know, doing something that appears tomorrow. And so let's really phase in and get our feet wet within the course exams relative to these new tests. What I do wrestle, though, with is, so what are districts supposed to do with those in the meantime? And so maybe if you can expound a little bit more about how you envision the department. And perhaps Sister Mattson, you can weigh in as well, how you envision the department working with districts relative to making sense of using end-of-course exams during this transitionary period of time for those upcoming pending new graduation requirements.
Mr. Chair, the intent would be that these tests, and Mr. Mattson, correct me, I don't have the language precisely in front of me, would not be administered until 15-16. So we would have time to develop those end-of-course tests. The expectation then would be that districts would be required to use them. Teachers, if they were teaching chemistry, physics, or geometry, would be required to use them as they are as part of their testing process. So they would be part of their final grade. We are not suggesting at this point, because the phase one will be operational during that time, we'll be able to look at the success of the end of course in mathematics and science. We'll be able to look at the alignment process, how successful that was. So what I have proposed is that we go ahead and develop the end of course in 2015-16, you said, they would begin to be administered. And at that point, we still have plenty of time then to make any decisions, if you will, on whether they would be part of a course grade. But these would be tests that would be there for districts to deliver, to be required to be used as part of the course process.
And members, you do have in your packet, I assume the department prepared this, or is this prepared? Yes. Overview of the commissioner's recommendations. And so we can look at both how it compares with our current grad system. So I want to make sure that members are aware of that. Are there other questions? Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, first of all, I want to compliment you on your work here. It's a very respectful of the many months of work that were done by the task force, and it has a holistic integrity, I think, in terms of a vision for our accountability system. I also want to call attention to paragraph F and G, where you expand the Assessment Advisory Committee and contract for two independent studies. Both of those directly address the concerns I raised earlier about constant monitoring of the process. So I think those are excellent provisions. And then I'd like to ask Dr. Mattson if he would just speak briefly to the construction of the alignment index.
Dr. Mattson, good luck trying to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dirk Mattson, Director of Research for the department. I'll try and do it without pictures. And Kent said, I think that was a backhanded compliment to my pictures. I'm not sure. The alignment index, in general terms, our intent of doing this alignment index is, as Mr. Bickel mentioned, to try and look at what researchers have done already and try and put that on the front end as a thoughtful process, as opposed to looking at the back end. Georgia, for example, is one state that's been noted numerous times where they did a research study, they found there is this great discrepancy, and they kind of are now what? And so we tried to be thoughtful in that committee about putting that at the front end. The alignment index essentially is the concept behind it, and there will be need to be more conversations about working this out with additional technical folks. Let me just briefly say, too, we have vetted the idea with numerous national researchers and so on, and one of the folks that I have great respect for continually repeats, this is a very clever idea, and I think it's a good use of how to do the data, a researcher from the National Center for the Improvement of Educational Assessments. Essentially, it is a norm-based reference. So we would take, during the first 3 years that the commissioner talked about, it's actually, I'll break this out a little bit more definitively, the first 2 years, the way we at least have it scripted for a transition process, districts are not required to participate in the end of course because the MCA 2 will still be doing the heavy lifting for the accountability. But they, if they do have students participating, it's to their advantage, certainly, to see how they're performing on the new set of standards. So we would use those 2 years plus a full implementation in the third year to gather data and identify, and also we will, as the commissioner mentioned, and it's part of processes that are already going on for other measures as well at the department, to gather data on how those grades and the end of course performance, exam performance align. And once we have that information, we essentially have a conversation. It's like setting a norm. It's very similar to how the norm was set by in the growth model that was in recent legislation. Is we look at what's a recent rate, a good ratio, half a standard deviation, etc. And basically, I've originally compared this to, since I don't have a picture, I've compared it to a windshield chart, right? That you have kind of the green and then the yellow and then the red, where, you know, high wind speed and low temperature means it's really dangerous to go outside. Same kind of idea. Those are certainly just specific numbers they've pulled and based on research. We would do the same thing. We would combine those scores. We would look at that. We would look at the data and say, okay, it's almost a standard-setting process where stakeholders would get together and say, how much is good enough? What do we believe is aligned? So just to use the A through F metric on both of them, if a student is getting an A for the course and got an F in the exam, and again, we don't have those scores in the exams, but to use that as an example, if they got an A for the course, F for the exam, one would anticipate this is going to be a misaligned comparison. That doesn't mean that that student or that teacher automatically there is some kind of grave consequence, because we're always going to have this distribution of kids that are getting A's and kids that are getting F's is going to be few. Then we expect kids that are getting B's and got D's on the exam is going to be a few more, and we'll see it bunch up. It's a distribution. So the idea is to look at that distribution, determine where do we feel that's good enough to say, you know what, that's, and it's not just one category, but it has been proposed by the task force. It's actually four categories of, I think the, I'll remember them all, but aligned, closely aligned, moderately misaligned, and highly misaligned. I think I'm on the ballpark. And so determining where those cuts are for all four of those areas. So one would assume that if you have a bulk of students, not just one student, but a bulk of students that are A and F divergent, you would wind up in a highly misaligned condition. If you have a bulk of students that are in getting a C and getting a C, or getting an A and getting an A, you're going to be aligned. You're still going to have some of those kids trailing off in these divergent reasons for, as Mr. Pakel said, for reasons we may not know. But it's looking at the whole and saying, okay, overall, where are you in this alignment? So it's not saying because there was one student or one teacher. It's looking at an aggregate. And in the commissioner's recommendations, it's looking at that aggregate over 2 years before any action takes place.
Representative Daffy. And members, I do want to get to our other folks who have asked to testify as quickly as possible. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two areas of questioning. My primary concerns are fiscal, and I'll leave those for the Finance Committee. But I'm intrigued with the several references to online, developing these as online tests. And I'm aware that very aware that one of the ways that Minnesotans get so little value back from the millions of dollars we spend on testing is the poor quality of the information from the testing, but also the long delay, so that teachers and parents and schools get very little back for the millions of dollars of taxpayer money. If we move to computerized assessment, when, Dr. Mattson, will we get the results from a student's test?
Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney,
again, I would just, first of all, I would identify in the premise that we do have as technically appropriate tests as any test in the country, in fact, better than the majority of them. That the results don't come back quickly is definitely due to the paper results and the paper instruction or the paper administration. We have proposed in the task force, and I believe this would be necessary and proper, that it would be within 72 hours that results would happen. It would not happen in the first year because there is always technical work that needs to be done on the back end of the exam, calibrating, scaling, equating, that needs to happen on the back end of the first year of an inaugural exam in order for that to happen. So those results would be delayed, as we are anticipating with our online tests starting next year for mathematics in grades 3-8. We have said we will have immediate results, but not in the first year because we need to do that work. So our goal is to have them 72 hours. That means that we cannot have humans scoring these tests. So constructed responses look different on these tests as they do elsewhere. To your point very quickly, and again, I recognize your point about fiscal concerns, we have, as we've tried to begin estimating out costs, and we expect that fiscal note will be requested in conversation for your finance committee, we have been using kind of roughly a 75% computer, 25% paper as we transition. As a wonderful analogy I'll be sure to steal about building the house. We expect that 75% of the kids are going to be living in the computer house and 25% in the paper. For the near term, we don't know when that is, and that's based on just anecdotal at this point. We'll have a much better idea after this next year's administration of our first 3-8 online test that happens in every grade 3-8.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair, and I do, Dr. Matz. I end up very torn on the computer assessment. 72 hours is certainly less than what the private sector is able to provide, but it's certainly far, far better than what the department currently provides, and there's a great value in that. At the same time, using the school's limited computer capacity for testing rather than teaching has always been a source of frustration for me when I was a classroom teacher and even now today. I notice on page 6 there's a number of off ramps here for students. If you can pass a different state's test, you can do that instead. If you take an AP or IB class that might get you college credit, you can do that instead. Of course, there's the obvious absence of college in the schools, where you would not only maybe get college credit, but you would have college credit. But there's a number of off ramps here. Why go to developing a state test at all? Why not instead say, at the end of the day, you need to pass the ACT or the SAT at this level, you need to pass another state's test, you need to do AP or IB. Here's a menu. Take two from column A, one from column B, and not go through this whole rigmarole at all.
Mr. Chair, I also make a clarification here on the and we need to make this clarification to the bill, unless I am interpreting the work group's recommendation wrong, where it talks about passing another state's federal accountability exam requirements in the relevant subject of reading or writing in the same language is repeated. That is only if a student has moved in from another state and they've already taken the test. We do not necessarily want, and I'm not going to name another state and insult them, that may have lower standards that the student has passed that some kid here in Minnesota could choose. So that is only if a student has moved in. So I don't want that to be misinterpreted as far as that. And I don't know if that was clear from everybody about that.
And Dr. Matson, we spent quite a bit of time talking about this in the task force at the very beginning. What I really want is just, and Representative Davy, it's an appropriate question, but I do want to hear from the first two testifiers here, because I know that they're under a time constraint. And so perhaps just a very quick word, and then I'll ask those two to come forward.
Sure, I'll try and do it quickly. You're right, Mr. Chair. The task force definitely discussed it. Some states have moved to this. Absolutely. Michigan, Illinois, Maine have moved to, everybody takes the ACT. There is no, as I continually repeat, there is no, if one of the requirements both from us as a state and federally is it must be aligned to the state standards. And so any test, any of those options, we have to do some alignment to. The mainstay of that has to be aligned to state standards. So certainly it was an option the committee discussed. It did not germinate into the final recommendation, but as we testified, Mr. Pickell and I last week or last time we were here, that there are three options. There is creating an end of course, there are comprehensive, and there are just taking current college tests and augmenting them for the state's purposes.
Very well. I do have questions from Representative Loom, Representative Depke, and Representative Swales, but I'm going to hold off for a second if that's okay. I want to ask Mr. Matt Moles and Ms. Brenda Casilius if they can come forward. Both Mr. Moles and Ms. Casilius were on the task force, and I know that you're really pressed for time, and I really appreciate you taking time away from your district responsibilities to be here with us today. So I want to hear from both of you this morning. So good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matthew Moes, and I'm the Acting Chief Accountability Officer for the St. Paul Public Schools. Thanks for the opportunity to testify before you today regarding House File 3421, based largely but not entirely upon the recommendation of the College and Career Readiness Policy Institute's Working Group on Assessments and Accountability. As a contributing member of the group and a signatory endorsing the recommendations provided to the commissioner, I'm here to reiterate my district's support for the proposal put forward by the committee and to raise concerns about some of the key deviations reflected in the bill before you for consideration. Over the past 9 months or so, the members of this working group engaged in very difficult conversations about how to provide the commissioner with a recommendation that could garner the support of most, if not all, members of the group. Along the way, a number of passionately argued positions were debated, considered, and ultimately set aside in order to craft the proposal released on March 1st. It is a document reflecting an evolution of thought by some, including myself, a spirit of compromise by others, and a balancing of stakes for all parties affected by the proposed system. By the end of our deliberations, it was clear to me that making major changes to the proposal would alter this carefully crafted balance. Unfortunately, this bill makes three significant alterations that concern me. First, the legislation omits the one significant feature of the proposed access system that enjoyed virtually universal support among the members, the formative assessment component. This feature, dropped for cost considerations, had strong support among the members of the committee because formative assessment will support improved teaching and learning as teachers adapt to the new requirements. It demystifies these moderate to high stakes exams and provides resources for teachers and students to better prepare for the higher stakes tests later. The formative assessment component is vital to make these tests more about the learning in the classroom and the standards expected for all students to achieve, rather than an externally imposed accountability mechanism that's disconnected from the daily learning environment experienced by our students. Second, the legislation proposes a fairly significant and potentially very difficult to implement sanction on school districts without any evidence that such a sanction is necessary. Certainly, schools and districts will have to adjust grading practices when the access system is implemented. Given the wide variety of legitimate grading practices in place in St. Paul and around the state, the requirement to incorporate the end-of-course assessments at 25% of the final grade will force important conversations about grading practices at the local level, where most, I believe, will agree it's most appropriate to take place. The work group proposed the alignment index to determine if the final grades in the courses reflected the level of performance demonstrated on the exam, but not once did the work group discuss attaching what amounts to financial penalties to schools deemed to be highly misaligned for consecutive years. To encourage public and internal dialogue about grading and student performance, the alignment index likely could be crafted in a way to be deemed valid. To impose financial penalties on districts and to implement the monitoring system necessary to impose those penalties, the alignment index would need to meet a much higher threshold as an accountability system. I'd be interested in seeing how much it would cost to implement and enforce this provision as crafted in the legislation. Third, the proposed legislation collapses a judiciously crafted two-phase implementation plan for end-of-course exams into a two-year rollout that will have deep impacts on every high school in the state. I will not take time today to go into the logistical problems this proposal would create for St. Paul and other districts, but it's likely to be challenging and costly. Rather, the immediate implementation of geometry, physics, and chemistry lowers the bar for performance by the state. Many in the work group, myself included, believe that the next generation of high school assessments should not place the burden of accountability primarily on the students, as the current grad does. In the spirit of sharing stakes across all parties involved, including the state, The work group's recommendation included expectations for performance by all parties. For the state, whether it be construed as the department or the legislature, the expectation was threefold: to develop and fund a coherent system promoting college and career readiness, providing the support to ensure a focus on improved teaching and learning, and a demonstration that the implementation of phase one was effective prior to doubling down and authorizing phase two assessments in chemistry, physics, and geometry. The elimination of the formative assessments and the advancement of the phase two assessment essentially lowers the bar significantly for the statutory expectations for the state. Although I'm testifying today to raise concerns about important features of the proposed legislation, I am also here representing a large urban district that's largely supportive of the department's efforts to move forwards in the next generation of high school assessments to promote college and career readiness. In St. Paul, we have recognized the need for some type of public accountability going back to a time before AYP became an acronym as common as SCUBA. But we will continue to advocate for accountability that recognizes the complexity of the tasks in front of us, ensures that students do not bear the burden for the system, and ultimately supports improved educational outcomes for our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mose. Ms. Casilius, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for having this really important discussion here today and continuing to have this discussion. As Matt said, we have been engaged in this discussion for quite a long time with the committee, and some of us, as you know, have come quite a ways to support the current proposal here. And so as representative of Minneapolis Public Schools, we are supporting the current proposal that the committee brought forward to the commissioner. I want to commend Kent Pickell and Dirk Mattson on their co-leadership of this group. Personally, for me, I changed my schedule to come to this group, not so much because of my incredible passion for this topic, but also because of the minds of the folks who were there and the passion demonstrated by the discussion that was there, the real discussion about how we can improve our educational system for students. And that was extremely valuable, and I commend the commissioner on her engagement of all of us. She engages us, race to the top feedback. She engages us on all kinds of feedback on policy and procedures, and I really appreciate the commissioners continuing to reach out and work with our urban districts and other districts across the state for feedback. So I want to thank her for that. I want to start quickly with just an email that I got while I was sitting here about Washburn. Washburn, as you know, we fresh started Washburn High School 2 years ago. They are in their second year of a fresh start, and they are trying to put advanced coursework in place by having International Baccalaureate. We found out today that 439 students at Washburn, they have a student body of about 800 students, that 193 students chose 439 courses in IB for next year. This is amazing. Some didn't think that we would have 20 kids choosing IB courses next year, and we have 193 students who are choosing International Baccalaureate, and currently 10 students who said they want to go for the diploma. We have to have opportunities to continue to push high standards, high rigor, give our teachers the tools that they need to be able to deliver on that, and give students the feedback so that they can be successful. So in particular, how do we measure college and career readiness? That's the question in front of us. How then do we define college and career readiness, measure it, hold school systems accountable, and then what do we do about it if they don't meet up to those standards? That is really what we're trying to grapple with. Students do rise to the expectations that we set for them. This has been seen with our Minnesota Basic Standards Test. Students will rise if they know clearly what it is that they're going to be held accountable for. So we are not against the major components in this proposal. Some pieces, like Matt said, that deviate, that cause us some pause, are the Section 325 with the diploma and being able to mark a diploma as honors. There was some discussion about a differentiated diploma. I want to be sure that we don't get to the point of differentiated diploma in this policy. 5.5, second semester of senior year to appeal. We discussed the process of appealing in committee and when students should be able to appeal. I think second semester of the senior year could be potentially too late for our students in order to remediate and get them ready. written notification in 626, the grade 7 through 12, and reporting. I just think reporting needs to be a bigger discussion still in how we report that out, and is that individual reporting and worried about capacity of school districts. 6.29, district funds to pay for higher ed. Matt talked about this. This is something we did not discuss on committee, and I know that our district currently is struggling to pay for the current requirements and graduation standards in our schools, and I'm not sure how we would pay for higher ed sanctions. 7.1, the transcript and writing on the transcript, levels of college readiness. This is a, you know, we think about our students in their ages 14 through 18, and we think about college readiness, and this transcript follows you through life. And then finally, this is in addition to St. Paul, the additional course exams in phase two being put now in phase one. We really would like to see the outcomes of phase one and the success and be able to really monitor that with the external evaluators and see where we're at and be able to then add if we feel that this has been a successful system. And then finally, some things that were taken out of the bill that I think we really felt were very important in our compromises as we supported it, which were the academies, the teacher supports for students with the Common Course Catalog, and really working with teachers and kind of streamlining how we did our standardizing and supporting teachers through professional development, the formative assessment that Matt had already mentioned. And then there was a really specific provision in our recommendations around immediate feedback. We put in there that schools would be given 72 hours feedback for the results, and this would allow us then to quickly respond and intervene with students. So I want to end by saying that I really urge this body to look at not only the recommendations before you, but also to look at this in regard to a racial impact study and the equity of this, and what really these, how these policies really will impact not only our economic conditions within our city and state, but our life opportunities for our students, and also access that I talked about when I first opened here to advanced courses. If our students have to remediate after every course that they fail, they will be spending a lot of time remediating rather than taking the IB courses that they've selected. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Casilia. So, members, we are at the end of our allotted time. We will bring the bill forward for action on Friday. We still have a number of legislators who had questions, and we will keep you on the list. We also have other folks that wish to testify from the Business Partnership, from the Chamber of Commerce, and from AMSD, and I suspect some others as well. And so I'm looking forward to continuing this discussion. The chair and the author of this bill will be wrestling with what was shared here today, and may very well come in with an amendment to the bill. I welcome anyone who has thoughts or recommendations to work with me over the course of the next day or so, but then also obviously welcome you for action on the bill on Friday. So with that, members, we will not meet this evening. We will be back here tomorrow morning at 8:30, and I want to thank you all for a good discussion today. Thank you. This committee stands adjourned.